Blinded by the light is indeed what some people experience, not from the brightness of the Phoenix lights, which we'll be celebrating an anniversary here coming up very shortly on March 13th, but from the glare of the spotlight of what happened afterward. Some people are more or less comfortable with what they saw that night and what they're willing to say about it. But Dr. Lynn Cataille says she was once a skeptic, and now she's a total believer. She's a graduate of Temple University, also Temple University School of Medicine, completed postgraduate studies at the Medical College of Pennsylvania. She's somebody who has a reputation to risk, and she says she still will not back down on what she saw March 13th, 1997. And she'll tell us all about it coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Well, let me just make sure I've got it pronounced correctly before I go any further. Dr. Lynn Cataille, correct?
Pretty close.
What do you say, Cataille?
Cataille.
Cataille.
Like a key and a tie.
You know, that's not even
close.
That's
why I go under Dr.
You're giving me too much credit. It wasn't even close. Don't even say that. I don't deserve that.
Yeah, you did good. Let me tell you.
Okay.
You know.
Well, I understand
that. 38 years. What's up?
I understand that, but I just I like to get it right. And there is something that's really important about getting details right about this night, because
right.
Still the amount of controversy that comes out of this story. And, you know, I was talking to some people tonight who still, I mean, after all, you would think after all of the television coverage, after all of the conversations that have gone on, books written, that everybody would know what really happened that night. In the story of the Phoenix Lights, March 13th, 1997. And so I'm really looking forward to you setting the record straight. Also for fellow skeptics out there like you once were, who still can't believe what you say you saw.
I can totally appreciate that. And I really appreciate having the opportunity to share. And you know, you said at the top of the hour that I haven't backed down. Well, let me tell you, it was a very, very difficult decision coming forward. I stayed anonymous for 7 years after the mass sighting, really searching meticulously for a logical explanation. I went down to the University of Arizona Optical Sciences Department, Consciousness Study Department, Arizona State University, Anthropology, Astronomy, Geology, Mathematics Departments, as well as the renowned Brooks Institute of Photography. And across the board, no one could give me an answer as to what my photographs, and I do have a very unique collection of these, what I've discovered, global unexplained phenomena. If people want to take a peek at the website, the Phoenix Lights Network, at www.thephoenixlights.net, that after compiling a journal, once thousands of people had seen what I had seen actually 2 years prior to the mass sighting and 2 months prior to the mass sighting, and had captured photographs at that time, as well as during the mass sighting, one of the handful of signature videos of that evening, and then found out a week later, because I knew nothing about this topic at all or was ever interested in it, but now thousands of people had seen what I had been seeing, plus the fact I learned that this was happening worldwide. I had no idea. And that really set me on a journey to find a logical source and meaning for what I had witnessed and documented, and I have yet to find it. If anything, it opened up a whole new world to me that ultimately, after pushing my entire professional medical career aside for 4 years, ended up with a 750-page journal that I really had to do lots of soul-searching what to do with this, and I continue to take pictures and continue to learn more and more of the history. There is such a history of this that we can talk about as well that was just so compelling and so mind-boggling that finally my life's work, by the way, Ian, for over 35 years has been community education for the reality of vital health issues. I produce video and workbook curriculums on the reality of AIDS and teen pregnancy and substance abuse prevention education for schools worldwide. Discovery Education is distributing them. And when this fell in my lap, I have to say I felt obliged to do the same for the reality of this vital topic and squeeze the best of what I found in that from that 750-page journal to 220 pages and came forward in 2004 with the data. And I have tried to really relay the data as it unfolded. The data speaks for itself. It's not about me.
Right.
It's about the data. And if I can be a credible voice so people actually look at the data, then I've done my job.
Well, let's go back then to that night, March 13th, 1997. What were you doing? What was your day like on March 13th leading up to what you saw?
Actually, March 13th for me was like another day that had been occurring for a couple months. My husband and I, he's also a physician, had a very close sighting to our home in 1995. I did get pictures of that experience. It was very close to our mountainside home. And we can get and explore that a little later, which is some new material I'm now sharing in the new book that just came out this week. But 2 years later, I hadn't seen anything similar to these orbs, these amber orbs that were literally outside our window, and couldn't understand where this advanced technology came from that would be in a mountainside gated private community, and didn't even know where to look or to who to tell. I had no interest or knowledge of this topic. And then 2 months before the mass sighting, in January of 1997, these orbs, these huge orbs, came back again at a distance in formation, massive formation, which, by the way, was the exact same formation in the same location as would happen March 13th as well during the mass sighting. But I happened to catch six pictures in a row, and I have them on my website as well, the Phoenix Lights .net, Phoenix Lights Network, that show this phenomena head-on turning into a V-shape. And what's really poignant about this is that the second picture is exactly what people statewide would describe 2 months later, five lights in a row in a V-shape formation with two trailing. And it was so unnerving because that was so massive and really unnerving, not having had an explanation for the 95 close sighting, that I called around and found air traffic controllers at Sky Harbor International Airport the next morning who saw the same thing at the same time, and it was in Class B restricted airspace. Now, this is about a 30-mile radius around the airport where whoever is in that area has to call into the tower. Well, no one had called in, and here was this phenomena sitting there. It did not show up on radar. They took the binoculars, high-powered binoculars, to look, and in their description, which would also be a description for many people statewide on March 13th, they were six points of light, massive span, over a mile wide, equidistant from each other, that seemed to be attached to something, but they couldn't quite see what it was what the lights were attached to, and they turned in synchrony, and that must be what my pictures are indicating, and then slowly went behind South Mountain. And I said, so what were they? And there was silence. And then one of the air traffic controllers said, beats me. And I said, you're an air traffic controller. You're
right.
A professional sky watcher.
Who else do we turn to? If you don't know, who else do we call?
Exactly. And you know, they made it very clear that it wasn't anything conventional. And we kept in contact, and I continued to take pictures. It was, as a scientist, I felt compelled to document these strange phenomena on film up into and including March 13th, which was another night for me. And what was interesting is that the same formation appeared in the same location around 10 o'clock, just at 10 o'clock, the night of March 13th. And I immediately ran out there. And by the time I got out there, I got the three lights, like the end points of a giant triangle over the city. And again, the next morning, spoke with the air traffic controllers, and they saw the same thing at the same time. It was in the same location. And that, it's very interesting when you look at the data again, because right behind, just south of the airport, is South Mountain. And there is a basin in between South Mountain and the next mountain range is the Estrella Mountain Range. And Estrella, by the way, means star in Spanish. But what makes it even more intriguing is that about 6 months before the mass sighting, I was invited serendipitously, and I have come not to believe in coincidence, I have to tell you, because so much has happened that is just too coincidental since the mass sighting. But I was invited to present my substance abuse prevention program for the Gila River Indian Reservation School. There's one school there. And we got a little friendly, and after the mass sighting, I noticed that my pictures seemed to occur, these phenomena seem to occur right where South Mountain and the Estrella Mountain Range are intersecting, and that's where the Gila River Indian Reservation is. It's very sacred ground. So I called and asked them, did anybody happen to see any lights on March 13th? And they started to giggle, and I said, is that funny? And they said, are you kidding? We've been looking up at them for centuries. We call them sky people, light beings. It's part of their culture. I had no idea. They feel that they're spirit world, and they're very comfortable to invite them in. They feel that they give them comfort and advice. And then I started learning that there's other indigenous groups worldwide that actually have protocol to call these things in. So there you go. I mean, this is information right here in the Phoenix area that I had no clue about. And there's also other history here with petroglyphs. There are people that are studying petroglyphs that are very indicative of visitations from beyond. So it's very interesting, and they call the Estrellas the gateway to the stars. Maybe it is a portal.
It's a very interesting idea. Now, let me give you an observation from just hearing you over the last 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. You talk like a scientist. You speak in exacting terms, but you don't. And this isn't criticism, but it's just feedback. I'm not hearing a lot of how this impacted you emotionally when you saw it. And I know
that's half of the book.
Is scientists have to be pushed sometimes to talk about emotion. So
no, I hear you. Well, again.
So what was going through? What was going through? What was the experience like for you, as you saw this thing that you couldn't process? And talk about that in kind of a narrative form of take us there that night and what you were experiencing when you were seeing these lights.
Well, you know, I have to say, when you see something that's outside of your realm of what we're told is reality, it certainly touches on something not only foreign, but your curiosity is certainly piqued. And I have to say, there's a whole train of thought. I mean, it's very interesting when you look at how the event affected people, even in real time. There were many things going on, by the way, on March 13th. While thousands of people were looking up at the sky for a glimpse of the Hale-Bopp comet, they also saw these mile-wide formations of lights that seemed to be attached to something, as the air traffic controllers would say. And other people actually saw craft. We have compiled now, after 12 years of diligent, meticulous work, the UFO Reporting Center, Village Labs, Jim Delatoso and Michael Tanner, Bill Hamilton, Councilwoman Frances Barwood, hundreds of reports from her, as well as the Arizona MUFON, to show now on our website, it's called GAP, the Geospatial Animation Project, that there were about eight or nine different types of craft throughout the state, and we're talking for many, many hours. We have reports starting about 5:20 to 5:30 the next morning. There were Boeing crewmen out going to work in the morning that saw the same phenomena. So this is going on for many, many hours. Of course, the bulk of people were reporting seeing this between 8 and 10 or so when most people were outside. But to get to your question, which is a really good question, because we have to remember, about 6 months before the mass sighting, the movie Independence Day had come out. And we have been so inundated with the fear factor and the threat factor of these visitations, these possible visitations, that it really sets off a fear within us when we see something strange, especially children. And when children, who, by the way, were usually the first people to see it and alert their parents to these mile to 2 mile wide phenomena coming towards them, were frightened, and they would jumping up and down, Independence Day, Independence Day. But as the phenomena got closer, and we're talking, this is very low altitude, these phenomena glided right over their heads, rooftop, about 30 miles an hour. Some people did see it take off at tremendous speed, incredible technology to be sure, totally silent. And as it came closer, and some of these people saw it right above them, a calmness came over everyone, a connectedness to the phenomena, so that when it passed by, the kids wanted to chase after it and get in the car and so forth. That is very poignant when you really look at that data, and it has affected people at a very deep level to this day. So when people blow it off as flares or balloons or whatever, that doesn't happen with flares and balloons. I mean, this is a change in worldview type of thing that happened to people throughout the state. And I still get emails. I have thousands of emails from people who were affected by these phenomena, not only here, but worldwide. As far as me personally, is that what you were asking?
Yeah, I am. About you personally.
Okay.
I mean,
well,
what was that like for you? And I know that, I can hear, too, that you're so experienced at breaking things down into sort of an educational kind of model that we can follow. And so how would you break that down for us, for people who wanted to know what that was like to experience it through your senses when you were watching something that you could not ratify with your previous position of skepticism?
Absolutely. You know, let me go back to the very very first sighting, and I think that might help explain a little bit, because, again, I had no interest or knowledge in this at all. And in 1995, I was leisurely taking a bath, and my husband, who also was a skeptic, called me out of the bath to our bedroom window. And one wall of our bedroom is a window, and we're pretty high in the mountain. We have a panoramic view of the city skyline, so we know what cars look like and planes and helicopters and so forth. We're very familiar with that. And this was quite different. He said, you know, get over here quick. Look at this. And a little below us, over a private gated residence, were three amber orbs in a pyramid formation, one on top and two closely aligned underneath. It was startling, but incredible to see something like this. And I immediately looked underneath to see if anybody was creating, and it was pitch black. And it was, you know, very hazardous desert ground anyway. And, you know, I thought to myself, something really struck me that it was so anomalous and so awesome that I tried to take everything in mentally, the size, the shape, the color, and so forth. They were about 3 to 6 feet each, depending on how close they were. They seemed to be about a city block away. I called them an orb because the light did not extend outside the edge. The light was self-contained within each object, and they were oval-shaped like an egg on its side. And they were three distinct objects, very closely aligned, and they didn't glare at all. The light inside each orb was a uniform amber color throughout, and I could immediately notice that all the other lights out there glared. These did not. They were mesmerizing and soothing, and it was really an amazing, amazing experience just to see this. And I thought to myself, if I don't get a picture of this, no one's going to believe it. So I ran to the closet to grab my camera. My husband calls me back, get over here quick. One of them is disappearing. And as we both watched, the top orb, without budging. Now, I have to say, the only movies that I had seen prior were E.T. and Close Encounters, and we have two sons that during their childhood growing up, we watched Star Trek a bit. And I remember, you know, the Romulan cloaking device.
Remember, right.
Like it wavers a bit. This did not do that. This was rock solid. It didn't budge, but it was dimming very, very slowly. And after it dimmed, it felt like it was still there. As if perhaps it went to another dimension. I had no concept of where it could have gone, but it felt like it was still there. I immediately got out onto the balcony, shot a picture of the two lower orbs, and felt an eerie silence. As if time.
Well, let's leave this right here at that eerie silence, and that's just where we will return with Dr. Lynn. I'm going to try it again. Kitai. Dr. Lynn Kitai. who has written a new book about the Phoenix Lights. You can link up to her through coasttocoastam.com, and she'll pick it up right there, The Eerie Silence. And she'll explain why what she saw and what others saw and what her photographs prove could not have been flares dropped from a plane. Coming up next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punt. So more from Dr. Lynn Kitai coming up throughout the evening. We're talking about the Phoenix Lights anniversary, March 13th, 1997. For her, it started with a previous sighting, but her life was really changed on that night, and it took many years of sorting out what to do with the photographs and with her notes before she's come forward with her material. She's one of the most credible witnesses of this night, which the military says is all a big misunderstanding. Why they're just flares dropped from a plane, part of an experiment for a nearby military installation. Case closed, right? We'll talk to Dr. Lynn about this next and find out why that can't possibly be true next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Dr. Lynn Kitai, the author of the new book on the Phoenix Lights, you can link up to her through coasttocoastam.com. It'll take you to the website where also you'll be able to see photographs, many photographs, that Dr. Lynn had been working on for a long time, sorting out and back, you know, trying to fact check, trying to vet in order to understand if she didn't see a craft from outside of our human experience, then what was it? So you back up a little bit where you were, just for people that might be coming in, and continue that the narrative. You were telling it so well of what you were experiencing the night you saw these lights.
This was 2 years prior to the mass sighting in 1995, right, when my husband, who's also a physician, and myself saw a very close sighting to our home. And I had just watched three amber orbs. The top orb dissipated, just faded from view ever so slowly, as if it was still there after it disappeared. And I quickly stepped out onto the balcony, noticed a very eerie silence as if time had stopped. And I took a quick picture of the two lower orbs, and you can find that on the website, thephoenixlights.net. And as intently as I was looking at these orbs, it felt that there was an intelligence watching me. And let me tell you, I did not share this with a soul until after the mass sighting, because it just seemed so bizarre. But in my mind, I was thinking, who are you? What are you? Do you know that I'm here? I'd love to meet you. And the next thing I remember, the left bottom orb started to disappear, and I quickly shot a picture of that. That was the only one that turned out at the time, but for me, it was confirmatory that we had seen something very unusual. I didn't know what it was, but I got a picture of it. And interestingly, when we finally did go back to those pictures, and that was not until a year and a half after the mass sighting, when we really inspected those pictures very meticulously and noticed not only was the same phenomena in the background, in the distance, in a line disappearing when the close orbs were disappearing in the same location as 2 months before the mass sighting and during the mass sighting. Again, the data speaks for itself. But at that time, we had had another sighting in 98 where I alerted some of the people that were in different directions. So we had people situated north, south, east, and west that captured a 20-minute array of these straight lines and mirror images, and the grand finale was this giant triangle in the same location again as my other pictures. And again, I had gone to great lengths to have my photos explained to me, and was only told that no one ever had taken both 35 millimeter and video from the same vantage point prior to and prior, during, and after an historic event. And I was looking for other outside experts, and found, was advised to call Dr. Bruce Maccabee, Navy optical physicist, renowned not only in ufology but also as a physicist, and sent him the video of the four arrays that we caught in 98. And as an afterthought, I stuck in the two pictures from 95 sighting and asked him if he could possibly tell me what they were, if someone of credence could examine them and actually tell me what they might be. And he came back a couple weeks later and he said, how long was that sighting in 95? And I said, oh, 2-3 minutes. He said, are you sure? I said, that's what it seemed. He said, that's impossible. And I said, what do you mean? He said, look at the pictures. And it's right there. I've had them up on the website since 2004 when I came forward after 7 years of anonymity. And I put the data out there. And he said, look at the skyline. The skyline in the first picture has many more lights on it than in the last picture. And we're talking groups of lights, not just individual lights.
Right.
But I'd like you to do an experiment. Now, talk about wrapping your head around this, okay?
Right.
He says, you know, at the same position, try to take the skyline for 15 minutes one night, a half an hour another night, and see when the lights start going off. Now, I usually take a bath between 7 and 8 in the evening, and let's be conservative that my husband called me out of the bath at 8 o'clock. Well, we were finding, as I was taking pictures of the progression during the night of the skyline, that the first lights start going out around 9 o'clock, and the last picture is indicative of around 10:30, 11 o'clock. Okay, what do you do with that?
Right, exactly.
At that point, you asked me how I felt. I couldn't even deal with it, to be totally upfront. I mean, this was something so beyond anything. I just couldn't even go there. I was just learning about UFOs in general and history and that this is happening worldwide and so forth. As it turned out, Dr. McAbee presented the case at the MUFON International Symposium in 1999 as the first, and this is in Washington, D.C., as the first photographic evidence ever of missing time. Now, what I shared with you is what I remember. This was so bizarre that I just never thought I would ever divulge it, ever, because it is so bizarre. But as it's turned out,
right.
Now I have to say that not only have I tried to deal with the data, and I really have. I mean, anybody that looks at the book knows that I've really tried to do my homework, and we'll get into the other things with the military and so forth. I mean, I really tried to do the homework, not only for myself, but then it was so apparent that I had done it for others that really want to know about what happened here. And as far as this data, which is the new data that's part of the new data that I'm sharing in the new book, if the data could be really important in helping us to really open up the door to what quantum physics and quantum mechanics is now starting to really investigate, Dr. Michio Kaku and
Michio Kaku.
Kaku and
right.
And others are really starting to look at other dimensions, the possibility
sure.
of many dimensions along with ours. And if you look at the possibility of other times and places along with ours, times and spaces, it might not be such a long
step. No, it makes perfect sense.
Intelligences
yeah,
in those other times and spaces. And, you know, when you also look and at the point that it took us 17 centuries, I mean, it took humankind 17 centuries before the advent of the microscope to realize that there are zillions of microorganisms, living entities all around us, even in our bodies.
Sure.
Some are pathogens, some are beneficial. We've learned to deal with it. And just in the past few decades, we've learned that there are electromagnetic energies that around every living cell. Well, just because we can't see those tiny living entities or electromagnetic energies or radio waves and so forth, it doesn't mean that it's not real.
Of course not. You know, I want to back up, though, because you brought up so many interesting pieces along the way. I want to go back to when you first contacted outside scientific perspectives to go over what you experienced. So then I want to get to the missing time segment too. But when you did that, would you have been relieved if they had come back with an earthly explanation for what you had seen?
Sure. I mean, I consider myself a healthy skeptic. When you're a physician, you must be open to things. And
right.
but with a skeptical eye, and I really was searching for a logical explanation for what I had witnessed and photographed. And across the board, nobody could give that to me. Everybody was fascinated, if anything, with the data. And it just became apparent as I learned more and more of the history of the of these phenomena. I mean, there are not only drawings in primitive caves in Pakistan and so forth. How did these people know what a UFO would look like unless they had
right.
seen one? And on and on with paintings in this in
sure.
the 18th and 17th century. And if you really look in the Bible, there's also references to vehicles being taken up into the sky or in the sky, as well as orbs. And orbs certainly are indigenous to indigenous people. They have been talking about them for centuries. So, you know, the fact that these things in Western culture haven't been embraced doesn't mean they're not real.
Well, no. And I'm just saying, but in terms of your own experience, mm-hmm. you would have been relieved if he had come back and said, oh, here's how it is. Now, as far as the missing time angle is concerned, how much, again, give me the idea, how much missing time do you think you experienced that night of the sighting?
Well, if we look at the data, we're talking at least an hour to 2 or 3 hours.
Okay.
And
now,
and the data speaks for itself. And you know why I came forward with it, Ian, also at this point? Not only because, you know, I really believe now that everything is for a reason. And I was offered by the new owner of Hampton Roads, Randy Davila. He was coming through town this past summer with Eckhart Tolle, and we started chatting. And I said, you know, a lot's happened since I came forward in 2004, not only with other sightings and interviews, and, of course, our former governor, Pipe Symington, came forward right after the 10th anniversary to say that he actually saw this craft, and it was not of this earth, and he had originally mocked it, and we can talk about that too. But you know, I figured he asked me if I wanted to do another book, and I said no. But you know, I had done so much work with this one, and really had compiled a 750-page journal that I inevitably felt obliged as an educator. I've been doing this for 30 years to squeeze the best of what I found, and also, there's a lot of healing to be done here, too. We can talk about that, because so many people have had experiences. Most things can be explained,
mm-hmm.
but a small percent cannot. And when you have an unexplained phenomena experience, what I call an up, and we can talk about that, too, because that's another thing that I get into in the book, the connection between all unexplained phenomena. When someone has an up experience, it's real to them, and it's so important that they feel comfortable in sharing it. And that was another reason, as a physician, that I felt it was important to come forward and say, it's okay to talk about it. It's healing to talk about it.
Right. So who else would have experienced that missing time, that chunk of missing time with you that
well,
night?
My husband was inside and I was outside, and I had
you were outside.
That he too remembers that it was just a few minutes, and he would never talk about it. That was one thing that was very strange to me, because to me it was wondrous and incredible and just fantastic and such an exhilarating feeling to have seen something so unusual and so anomalous. He would never talk about it. He didn't want me to bring it up. He would not talk about it, and that was that. And that to me was, you know, everybody comes from a different background, a different upbringing, a different belief system. And some people, it will take longer than others to have this sink in, or they don't even want to deal with it. And that's okay.
Sure.
Everyone in their own time.
Right. So have you ever been regressed hypnotically?
No, and I don't choose to be right now. I have to say that's another reason I wanted to share this data, because not only could it possibly help us move forward in our own understanding of time, because we maybe linear time, the past, present, and future, is primitive, that we have to start really looking at and embracing, and science needs to come on board. That's really important here. I don't know what these things are, but I know that they are. And it's time we get it out in the open, and we address it, we accept it, and we study it so we can move forward in our own evolution. So that was one of the reasons that I really wanted to come forward with this, to say, hey, look at the data, and certainly you can make up your own mind what you think it's about, but it's there, and hopefully it will help with quantum physics and the thought that, hey, you know, maybe there is parallel time, there's other dimensions out there, and this is one step towards showing that data to make it a reality.
And I understand everybody has a right to be resistant to something like hypnotic regression, but have you, in light of the fact that time differential could be as long as 2 or 3 hours, what do you, without going through hypnotic regression, what do you imagine you were doing during that entire time, just standing there?
I can't even imagine, but that was the other reason that I thought it was important to share this, because Dr. McAbee says in his paper, and we have the whole thing on our website and a bit of it in the new book, that, you know, an abduction researcher came up to him after he presented at the MUFON International Symposium in 1999 in Washington, D.C., and said, you know, are you saying that this person took, because I was anonymous at the time, perhaps a photograph of a clock? And he said, he thought for a second, and he said, well, you know what? Yes, of a sort. And besides the point of linear time possibly being, you know, that's our concept of time being primitive, the other thought is that contact has been so ostracized and maligned in the media and in movies and even by some UFO investigators. I'm not saying that everything out there is benevolent. But, you know, maybe it's time to realize that our own concept of what's happening, as Dr. Gary Schwartz in the documentary, we have an internationally award-winning documentary that's out there as well, that where he says that, you know, if you're terrified of seeing something, and then you see something that you're terrified of, what are you going to do? Your own beliefs are going to call you to believe you're going to have a negative experience. So it's your belief structure that has prevented you from having the positive experience that's really there. And then Dr. Ruth Hover, who is a PhD psychologist who runs a group of experiencers for 20 or some years in Fountain Hills, makes a very poignant statement when she says, when people recount an experience, it tells more about them than it does about the experience. If they need to be angry, they usually vent annoyance. How dare they? If they're frightened, they're going to be afraid. But if you're open to it, and that's all I can speak to, my heart and my mind, and that's the first step. Our mind is like a parachute. If it's not open, it doesn't work. If you're open to these things and you have a positive outlook, you're going to have a positive experience. And I can only speak for myself personally that my experience has been extraordinary and wondrous and enlightening and comforting. And even Dr. Bruce McAbee has stated that if it wasn't for the Phoenix Light event and the Phoenix Lights themselves, I would never be doing what I'm doing.
Right.
So when people say, you know, is a flare or a balloon or a blimp or something, that doesn't change somebody's life as dramatically as certainly it's changed mine. I have felt compelled from my experiences, and I think that's the biggest plus to all this, and the biggest reason that this needs to be shared is that something is touching in the depths of individuals worldwide that is really waking them up, not only to the presence of something out there that's trying to communicate with us and let them know of their presence, but also is waking us up to who we are as human beings. And we can get into the whole spiritual thing, but it certainly is waking people up worldwide to what we're doing to ourselves and our planet before it's too late.
I have some directions I want to head to coming up here. We're talking about the Phoenix Lights phenomenon nearly 13 years ago. Coming up on March 13th is the anniversary of the one that so many people saw. I want to talk more about that particular night, too, with Dr. Lynn Kitai, who was an amazing eyewitness. And she'll share both coming up here why it is that she doesn't believe this could have been simply flares dropped from the sky or government plane formations from a National Guard group, or whether it's some other explainable phenomenon. We'll get into why the government's explanations don't work for her and what she saw coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett.